Future-proof gold from Newstalk.
Now, we're all probably loosely familiar with the idea that the dinosaurs were victims of a mass extinction event. You might not have known that it was the fifth such mass extinction in the planet's history. Are we in the middle of one now? And what does that mean for future survival of animals and us on the planet? Lauren Salen is a paleobiologist and Martin Merrison, assistant professor in interdisciplinary studies at the University of Pennsylvania. That is a long title, Lauren, but you're very welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. So let's start off with a definition, I suppose, of what a mass extinction is.
So a mass extinction is basically the worst period that ever happened for life on Earth. And it has a more technical definition than that. So basically, mass extinction is an event that wipes out biodiversity at orders of magnitude beyond what we call background extinction. So things are always dying. Some animals get into situations that they can't quite get out of. Either they populate a small island or they fall prey to some kind of new predator and they die off. And so we have a way of measuring sort of a background extinction rate. A mass extinction is somewhere far, far above that. So something that wipes out, say, 60% of all species or 90% of all species, or species that normally wouldn't have died and seem to be doing pretty well up to that point.
Right. Okay. So it's basically like a carpet bombing of species on a catastrophic scale.
Yes.
And so there have been five of these so far. How do we know if there have been five?
So it's a measurement of basically how diversity changes over the last 500 million years. So animals have been on the face of the Earth for about 500 million years since an event called the Cambrian Explosion. And by tracking what animals we know were alive, not just animals, plants, any organisms in the fossil record, we can look at rates of background extinction. And when we do that, we see these spikes, these five distinct spikes centered on five distinct events that mark pretty much mass death on a global scale. So it's a math problem, and it's a graphing problem that turns out to show us extreme devastation in a case where we wouldn't have known otherwise.
So with these five spikes, what exactly do you mean? Do you mean that there are five periods in time during which most of the species disappeared? How can we possibly know that?
By putting together really, really large databases of fossils. So fossils don't come out of the ground with a label, unfortunately. They come out as raw data. And we need to put that data together just like any other effort. Say, when data is collected about people's usage on Facebook or Google, we can put fossil data together in the same way. We can count up how many species do we know were alive and when did they actually exist. And by tracking changes in the number of species through time, we can see when we have spikes in what's called origination, or the production of new species, and when we have spikes in extinction, when we see a lot of species get wiped out at the same time. And so by tracking that extinction rate over time from our database, that's when we see these spikes.
Do these five events coincide with a big change in the layer of rock?
Yes, actually they do. So all the way back to Cuvier, who was a famous scientist in France 200 years ago, he proposed this idea of catastrophism. That is that he noticed that when you have changes between layers of rock or between major time periods, such as the Mesozoic, which is the age of dinosaurs, and the Cenozoic, which is the so-called age of mammals, that you tend to lose a lot of species then. So he noticed these mass extinctions before there was even a concept of mass extinction, before there was even a concept of evolution, just because you see this coincident change in both the species and the way the rock looks. Because the species themselves, especially things that make shells, actually contribute to the rock. And so when they die off, the way the rock is formed actually changes.
Right. Okay, so it's starting to make sense now. So these five events, do we know what caused each of the five? I mean, was it an explosion or a meteor? Do we know what the actual cause for these big events that wiped out so many species?
So there are different theories for different events, and some are known better than others. For example, for the end Cretaceous extinction 66 million years ago, the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, we have a pretty clear idea about what happened at this point. So we know that an asteroid hit the Earth in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and left a crater that's probably 150 kilometers across. We know that that caused a shock wave that went through the middle of the Earth and then activated this large area of volcanoes on the other side of the world in India, causing them to basically let go of 50,000 years worth of lava in a couple of days. So that's as far as we know, though. What we don't know is whether having basically a large space rock vaporized into the atmosphere and that much lava come out caused either horrible fiery apocalypse or nuclear winter. We do know, however, that pretty much all the plants died, the ecosystems were destroyed, and that on land, everything above, say, 5 kilograms in weight died off. So that's the best case we have for mass extinction. But there are other ones where mass extinction took something under 100,000 years, because that's the best resolution that we have, say, going back 440 million years. And we know that there was some extreme glaciation, like a sudden ice age, but we don't know the exact mechanisms that triggered that. And there's been talk of, oh, well, maybe land plants are to blame because they were first evolving at that point in time. Land plants bury carbon, the temperature falls, and then you get ice all over the place with a bunch of animals that don't know how to deal with it.
Huh.
So it's an ongoing investigation to figure out what caused these, but they definitely have different causes across the last 500 million years.
So it seems to me that does the length of time between these spikes have any relation to the size of animals? Because you said 5 kg, I presume you mean that all the big animals died. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
And do we know why the smaller animals survived?
So there are different theories for that. It's pretty common after mass extinctions to see what we call the Lilliput effect, which is this sort of reduction in size overall. And it may be that small animals take less energy, so they do better in highly unstable environments, say after mass extinction when there's not a lot of food. They also reproduce faster, which means that they only have to deal with these conditions for a little while, and then they sort of pass the ball on to their kids and say, hey, you go deal with it now, I'm done. So it's sort of like a mayfly or something like that. Whereas large animals, they require a lot more energy from day to day. They are pretty high up on the food chain, and so when the food chain collapses, because, say, all the plants are dead, it's a lot harder for them to get through it.
All right, so then by following that logic, when the gap between the two spikes is really large, then the animals just before that spike must be big, right? Because they will have a long time to get to big, or at least there would be a bigger proliferation of large animals. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's this other concept called Cope's Rule, which is named after a famous paleontologist in the 1800s who was part of the whole dinosaur wars out west, fighting over who got to name what dinosaur. But also, he's thought to have come up with this concept that if you have a longer time period, if you have animals that start out at small size, they just naturally get larger over time. And there's been many different explanations for this, because we do see it, especially in things like dinosaurs, mammals, also life overall, as it turns out. But it may be that if you have a really stable environment and a really thriving ecosystem, that prey have to get bigger than their predators, competitors try to get bigger than each other, and it just pushes everything to be much larger than we've seen before. In the case of the end Cretaceous, it turns out animals had something like 150 million years of stability to get really, really large in a really warm, conducive environment. And so that's one of the reasons that they were so big by the end. Then the mass extinction comes, they don't do very well, and the entire ecosystem thereafter favors smaller things for something like 10 to 20 million years.
Right. So where do we come from? Mommy? No, where do we fit in? Because obviously we're bigger than 5 kg. Are our ancestors the tiny creatures that snuck under the door, so to speak, of the last mass extinction?
Yes, so that's pretty much true of everything that we see. So anything under 5 kg, that includes mammals at that time. It includes birds, lizards, basically everything that we see come through that's not a large dinosaur. And there were some larger-ish mammals during the Mesozoic, so preceding this mass extinction, but they don't quite make it through either. Things that also get wiped out are large marine reptiles, whereas fishes that are under a certain size seem to come right through as well. So basically, the small inherit the Earth, and from there, mammals start the whole process all over again. So over the last 65 million years, mammals have generally gotten larger and larger as they come into competition with each other again. The thing about mass extinctions is they can be good and bad depending on which side you're on. So for things like mammals after the End Cretaceous was really good because it wiped out all of those big nasty dinosaurs and created a lot of new opportunities. And the thing is, this is pretty much true of every mass extinction. So a different event about 360 million years ago at the end of what's called the Devonian, which is supposedly the Age of Fishes, wiped out most of these large armored fishes, these large predatory fishes that had dominated the oceans and sort of lorded it over our ancestors, the early tetrapods, that is things with four limbs that would become land animals. A mass extinction that seems to have been caused by worldwide glaciers caused the sea level to fall dramatically. It wiped out all of these huge monsters and it opened new opportunities for our own ancestors, that is these things that actually have fingers. So that is the point at which tetrapods come onto land. And the reason that they're able to do that is that there are more opportunities on land. There's new opportunities in the water. And so they start diversifying all over the place. At the same time, the fishes that we're more familiar with, things like ray fin fishes, which now have 30,000 living species, and even sharks, which aren't primitive at all, as it turns out, start to diversify in the oceans. And so all of the animals that we're used to being dominant, including our ancestors, our relatives on land, the fishes in the ocean, they were all able to take over because a mass extinction happened to those big things that were part of a different group.
Right. The transition from for our ancestors to go from the sea to the land, what did those fossils look like? Because there must be some very strange looking things if there are our ancestors used to live in the sea and then grew fingers and pulled themselves on shore.
Yeah. So we are part of a large group known as bony fishes, which includes both the fishes that we see in the ocean now and also all the land animals.
I'm sorry, what?
We're part of a group called bony fishes. So we actually are still considered to be fish from sort of an evolutionary point of view.
No, I'm pretty sure that's no. No, that cannot be right. I kind of done this show for 8 years and just found this out now. We're part of a group called bony fishes.
Yes. And so there are two kinds of bony fishes. That's the bony fishes that we see in the ocean, which are called the ray fin fishes. And then this other group called the lobe fin fishes. So these fishes were the ones that were dominant before that end Devonian mass extinction, and they include things like coelacanths and lungfish that are now really rare living fossils. But in the Devonian, they were really, really diverse. And one thing about them is that within their fins, they have the precursors of our arm bones. So these were basically fish that had arms and then had a fin surrounding it. At some point, one group of these lobe fin fishes in the later Devonian decided to chuck the fin and develop fingers instead as a sort of paddle to swim around in the water more efficiently, something like a sea turtle. So it's sort of what's called an exaptation or a pre-adaptation, that fingers were developed for better swimming, but then, say, in the aftermath of a mass extinction when things are very unstable and you have to find food where you can, turned out they're pretty good for walking on land too. And so that's how we ultimately made that transition from the ocean to the land using the toolkit that we already had.
Isn't science fascinating? So do we know what the minimum point of survival is? Because obviously this reset button of a mass extinction wipes out maybe 90%. Do we know how bad it can get and yet still have life? Or is there a point at which we turn into an icy rock?
So it's gotten pretty low in the past, depending on what group you're looking at. So for shelly things in the ocean, at the end Permian extinction about 250 million years ago, the extinction rates are something like 97% to 99%.
Wow.
The ocean, we're almost boiling, or at least relatively boiling, at 40 degrees Celsius. So there were these large dead zones around the equator where most of the diversity is now, and they came back. And at the end Devonian extinction, we think our own ancestors were down to one species, and yet we came back. So as long as there's something left or something that has the ability to evolve new forms, that has sort of what we refer to as evolvability, that is able to generate has mutations that can generate new shapes that are well suited to taking over sort of ecological space, life does recover. It's just a question of how long it takes. So in a really devastating mass extinction, it takes about 10 to 20 million years for things to come back all the way. And in a mass extinction that only left, say, cockroaches alive, it might take even longer.
Okay, final question for you, and that is, are we in the middle of a mass extinction right now? And do you see any any way of it stopping.
So that's the point of a lot of this research. So the problem with looking at mass extinctions in the past is that except for the time that an asteroid hit the Earth, they take a lot longer than a human lifetime. So we are trying to figure out what it looks like to be in the middle of a mass extinction. How do you know when you're just seeing deaths that would have happened anyway? Do we know that, say, a population can be cut down to 10% of what it once was and bounce back, and how long does that take? And so we use data from the fossil record to determine what the rates of change are and compare that to what we're seeing now in order to determine whether we are in a mass extinction or not. The other issue is that mass extinctions can be very selective. That is, they can affect some groups and not others. So even the end Devonian mass extinction that killed off a lot of the fishes, it left a lot of the invertebrates alone. There have been other mass extinctions where all of the coral reefs die, but all the fishes are okay. And so if we look at that extinction and we think the mechanisms are similar to what's driving extinction now, maybe the coral reefs being bleached and the fishes still being there is an indicator of the mass extinction, even if the fishes aren't affected. So it's sort of an ongoing process. But the more data we get, the more exact comparisons we can make. We can tell whether the species we're losing were thriving before this happened. We can tell where the breaking point is. And then we can make predictions of how long it takes in general to recover from the kind of losses that we see. Is it going to take 10 to 20 million years? Because that's sort of the worst case scenario, that things will come back, but it's far too long in the future for it to really make a difference to anything that we're doing. But on the flip side, it may be that these losses happen much more regularly in the fossil record. We just can't see it that resolution, maybe. Right. And so it'll be a much more easy recovery. And then in the distant future, say 10 million years from now, like a future paleontologist won't even have known that this happened.
Interesting. Paleobiologist Lauren Salen from the University of Pennsylvania, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.